Okay, everyone, thank you so much for listening to Al's Place. We were listening to Rosalie Sorrells. We hoped we'd have a little more time for her, but I'm sure she'll be visiting again in the weeks to come. It's 11 o'clock right now. This is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, public radio for Alaska's interior. We invite you now to stay tuned for the Home Fire Show with Patty Kostelic. And the subject for conversation today is near and dear to all Fairbankians. That's hockey. Patty?
Good morning. Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. once again, I'm being very brave and talking about something I know really next to nothing about, and that is a very popular northern sport of ice hockey. With me in the studio are Rick Schaefer, the coach of the UAF ice hockey team, and the co-captains Don Jameson and Buddy Bender. Welcome.
Thank you.
They were sort of giggling at me. I went to the library, of course, is my usual approach to things, and got all kinds of books on ice hockey and have been reading them fast and furiously for the last day or so, especially one book which I had a wonderful time reading, Strange but True Hockey Stories by Howard List. This is a sort of Nancy Drew kind of version of hockey that I suppose is read by 10, 11, 12-year-old... You read it. How old were you when you read this book?
10 or 11.
It's a super book, a real good read. It's some fascinating stories. One story that I was just amazed at, because I have witnessed hockey games, well, not very many, four in my whole life, but where there aren't many goals made at all. And there's one guy in here... King Clancy, who I think it was King Clancy, who made 3 goals in 21 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That's just amazing. That's strange but true. All right.
And do you know what that 3 goals is, Patty?
That's when that little puck thing goes into the net.
Well, we'll have to look this up in the encyclopedia. That's a hat trick when a person scores 3 goals.
It's a hat trick. I know. I was all sports have, of course, their special language.
Right.
Why do you think I didn't see in any of my reading why it got the title of hat trick?
Well, as a matter of fact, as I recollect, what it used to be that if a person scored 3 goals, the club management would talk to the local haberdasher and then make arrangements for them to get a certificate so that they could get themselves a hat. All right, so they'd score 3 goals, they get themselves a free hat. Another thing, there's another old story passed around that in honor of the person that scored 3 goals, that the crowd would send their hats on the ice in respect for that person. So he'd get more than one hat, too, if he scored 3 goals. So
sort of like bullfighting,
real
where
incentive.
Everybody throws...
Oh, I don't like to think of it as bullfighting. In fact, the questions you had asked earlier, I hope you don't think that's the case about ice hockey. That it is indeed a rough sport, but you had brought up some of the old stories in 1906 where
it was indeed rough sport. I love this description. This is by a young boy in 1937 who didn't like the kind of sports coverage that the New York Times was giving to the ice hockey. And he was a real ice hockey fan. Eventually, he wrote this book called Everybody's Hockey Book that I've been reading. And he said, and he was probably about 11 at the time, he wrote a letter to the Times saying, "Hockey has the grace of ballet, the speed of a 100-yard dash, the color of a 4th of July pageant, and the rumble of a battlefield. There is no other sport quite like it because all of this action takes place on an unreal surface, ice."
Mm-hmm.
Which... I think it's a real interesting description. I was, in fact, interested to discover through this reading that hockey is becoming less violent rather than more violent. The early days of hockey was a real rugged sport, and I was interested to find out how old a sport it was. It, in fact, started in the 1800s in England and Scotland.
1870. Well, actually, the Canadians did claim that somewhere in Montreal that they had started the game. So University of Montreal students had
McGill,
started the game with a ball on frozen pond, and And then there are other stories with the Canadian Armed Services had started the game. I don't know where Don might know. He's a good Canadian boy. He should know this, have this on the tip of his tongue. But then every once in a while you can come across a picture in the Scandinavian countries, even a few centuries before, where they would have these sticks that were curled up and they would be on ice skates. So the actual start of hockey sometime in the last two or three centuries, but formal hockey as we know it today in the last 100 years. And yes, in the northern climates, in Canada is where it started, and it's spread now through, not completely throughout the United States, but to mostly in the northern climates and in a few places in the south. Surprisingly, you'd find hockey alive and well in a place like Huntsville, Alabama, or San Diego, or Flagstaff, Arizona. These are some of the places, in fact, schools that we play against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting. Of course, we have artificial ice now, and so climate really isn't a problem. In the early days of hockey, they played hockey outside, and of course in northern climates where there was limited light. And I was really interested in the descriptions they to keep the weather out. They started covering hockey natural ice rinks and had lanterns and ice fog, real poor visibility conditions. A lot of discussion about the changing size of the ice rinks, and as a result, the teams, they started out with nine members, went to seven, and then eventually to six. But when the ice rink was much bigger, of course, it could accommodate more skaters.
Exactly. Well, when they used to play on a lake, well, they didn't have the boards to the same height that they have them today, and it was just, if they had any at all, it may just be a snow wall. So there they didn't need to limit themselves. They could have a whole lake to themselves and play with as many members as they had.
Right. And, of course, you know, the usual curious things, which I have no idea whether it's fact or fiction, but they were talking about the goalposts, which did not originally have a net on the back, but were posts, and they change distance because someone came out with an obese hockey player who filled the entire space between the posts and no one could get the ball through. So they widened the posts, but of course now they're back to...
It's 6 feet across now.
6 feet across, yeah, so 4 feet high.
You'd have to be one obese goaltender to cover that.
But you have a lot of equipment that you wear.
That they do.
How about let's start with your background, Rick. When did you start playing hockey as a child?
I started as a youngster, probably about 5 years old, and I'm brought up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And hockey is just a way of life in the winter. We have long winters there, not quite so long as they are here in Fairbanks, but we used to have an ice skating rink in our backyard. Just something my father would drag out the hoses and put up. A few 4x4s, and this place where the children could unwind, and we had a whole neighborhood crew that played. Mm-hmm. And from there, I played high school hockey, and from there, I played college hockey at the University of Notre Dame, and after that, had a chance to play professional hockey for my first year out of school. Played for a short while in the now-defunct World Hockey Association, and then went over to Switzerland, where I played hockey for one season over there for a small town team there.
And hockey a popular sport in Switzerland?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. And here they have natural ice or artificial ice, and most of the rinks are outdoors. So you do play in weather mm-hmm. conditions. Mm-hmm. And it's also an interesting experience when you play in Switzerland, if you happen to be in one of the mountain towns, the ski villages, where you could be playing a hockey game, and you can look off on the distance, and there'll be little skiers zipping down the side of a mountain. It's really picturesque. In fact, mm-hmm. difficult to play hockey there because it is so beautiful.
Hard to concentrate.
It was hard to concentrate. It really was.
What town were you in Switzerland?
I was in a town called Olten, which is not too far from Zurich.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I went to the University of Notre Dame again as the assistant coach for five uh-huh. years, and now up to Fairbanks, and this is my fifth season up here.
What kind of a team did Notre Dame have when you were playing hockey for them and when you were coaching? Is that a good hockey power?
It was. Since that time, they've downgraded their athletic program, or at least their hockey program, to point where it's just a struggling varsity status. They went from one of the best teams in the league that they were in, and then they dropped the sport because of the expense involved, and there was a lack of interest. So,
is it a more expensive sport for our university to contribute to then, compare it to basketball or compare it to football?
Well, quite frankly, yes, it is. For this reason, there are many more people involved. We have 20 players that dress for each game. A basketball team, I believe, it's either 10 or 12 that can dress. The equipment, it's considerably more expensive than a pair of gym shorts and sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
To outfit our players with shin pads and elbow pads and shoulder pads and sticks are expensive. So there is a cost factor. And at the collegiate level, of course, whatever the number of athletes involved, the multiplied times scholarships and the cost of tuition fees, room and board to go to school. So that does make it a little bit more expensive a sport to fund by a university. But
Is it more expensive to keep the ice up than to maintain a gym?
Well, our ice arena here, that's a cost that we don't even consider right now. Our ice arena is very well used.
Mm-hmm.
From 5 o'clock in the morning until 12 o'clock every night. It is used by not exclusively the university during the day, of course, for classes and the varsity practice. But we have figure skating groups that use the ice and the youth hockey, men's hockey, women's hockey.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very well used ice arena. So that's not a cost that's taken into consideration.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to go to the two present co-captains of the UAF hockey team and ask you when you started skating. Don, you're from Penticton.
Penticton,
B.C. Anyone who knows anything about hockey, even the little that I know, knows that until very recently, perhaps the 1980 Olympics, the Canadians were the preeminent hockey players and really staffed the NHL, all the American teams. We didn't even have very many American players on our hockey teams until fairly recently, the last 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
It's a really big sport back at home. And in fact, Penticton even had a world championship team in 1955. Penticton V's beat the Soviet Union and brought it back to Canada. There was only one other trail. Smoke Eaters won it in 1961, and that was the last time Canada's won a world championship, I believe. Yeah.
I was born in Edmonton, and I went back for a few months when I was in the sixth grade. And one of the things that was really different from my school in the Midwest and that was interesting is that we all had skates at school, and they were on pegs. And at recess, you just put on your skates and went out the door, and I went wobbling out the door, and everybody else went flying out the door on those blades. But you started skating, obviously, at a real early age.
Yeah, I started when I was 5 or 6, same as Coach, and we had the same idea. We had rinks in our backyard, and we'd all play every day after school until it got dark, and either that or it got too cold to stay out. So we got an early start, and a good way to spend after-school hours.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Good exercise out in
mm-hmm.
otherwise cold weather. Do you stay warm when you can skate fast?
If you get a sweat, you know, it's good exercise.
I mean, I don't skate fast enough to stay warm, I can tell you. I also spend a lot of time on my behind. So, Buddy, did you also, you're from Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Northern Pennsylvania, so you had long winters?
No, it's right around Philadelphia is
mm-hmm.
where I'm from.
But we have the Philadelphia Flyers, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's, yeah. They are, in fact, hockey is a very popular sport in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia itself, it's picking up. It wasn't that big when I was growing up.
I wouldn't
get on the ice that often until I started playing organized hockey when I was ninth grade in high school is when I first got into organized hockey. And prior to that, it was just whenever the ponds froze during the winter, you know, I'd get out on figure skates and just, you know, shoot around for a little bit for a couple of days until the ponds melted, and then you'd wait for another couple of weeks until you got another cold spell, and then you'd get back out again. So
it isn't something that you, in order to be competitive, you must begin at a really early age.
No, ideally, I mean, it certainly helps if you have if you start at a young age. But if I might add here to Buddy, he's in a way a rarity as a hockey player. He comes from an area where it's popular as a professional sport, but they are. It isn't cold enough there in Philadelphia where they could skate for the same season that Don could skate or mm-hmm. say that the boys in Minnesota could skate. So it took, Buddy really had to, he fell in love with the game big time, as you might say, and he had to search for a lot of indoor ice, which was available, but it took a lot of driving and effort by his parents and on his part to learn how to play the game as well as he has. And then after, then he decided that if he wanted to play college hockey, and there was only one route for him to go to be noticed and recognized, and that was to go to all the way to Iowa. And Buddy went to Waterloo, Iowa, where he played in a junior league. This junior league is comprised of quite a few boys that have finished high school and love the sport of ice hockey, would like to go on to college and combine their college education with the chance to play college hockey, and this is a stepping stone for them, and this is the chance that Buddy took, and he did, and played very well, was on the All-Star team, and he too had gone to Switzerland. He had played in a World Junior tournament there following his last year in Waterloo, and we saw him and certainly liked everything we saw, and now that's why he invited him to come up here, and he's been a valuable member ever since. But I just point this out that again, from an area where it wasn't a given that he was going to become a hockey player, because there are very few hockey players in Ivyland, Pennsylvania, much more in the whole state of Pennsylvania, for that matter.
Yeah, I was reading here in this hockey book, everything I know about hockey is what I read in the last couple of days. There are 140 indoor rinks in Minnesota. That's in hockey rinks. I mean, not just plain ice skating rinks. Mm-hmm. So that really shows us that there are some places where obviously a lot of children have access to it, and it's really part of normal existence, which I suppose is why the Canadians have been such good hockey players and have really dominated the sport for so long. Although I also understand from the history of it that I don't, there are probably lots of myths, but they said that hockey really came into its own when all of these British troops were stationed in Canada in the late 1800s, the settling of Canada, and were bored with the long winter nights, and that's when they really started developing the sport of hockey, which makes a certain amount of sense, all these Mounties and...
Sure, that makes sense. It's an outdoor winter activity, aside from skiing. When you think of it, there aren't that many, unless you like ice fishing and skiing all the time, and this was one activity, a team sport, and its roots are, of course, outside, but since that time, I mean, there are some professional hockey players today that I bet if you asked them the number of times they've skated outdoors, and they could hardly answer. I mean, the sport has moved indoor. The best hockey players, I maintain, are the ones that spend all Saturday and Sunday afternoons and after school on outdoor rinks, where they just learn to pick up the savvy that's needed to become a really good hockey player. But that's not to say that can't happen on indoor rink if they have ample opportunity to skate indoors, but it just beats staying outside when it's minus 20, no doubt.
Yes, and it sounds like some of that ice outside, well, I know some of that ice outside can be real rough, can have some real surprises in it, some sticks and some bumps and some
rocks.
I have some friends that live out in the Goldstream Valley, and they do a lot of outside skating, and it's sort of like cross-country skating. You know, there's a layer of snow on the ice, and you never know
what's underneath.
It's a real adventure. But it really makes a lot of logical sense. To do a sport that's very compatible with the natural surroundings that you have. One thing that's very interesting to me was that hockey as a sport was not so well supported or not so popular at the college level until relatively recently. I mean, it's becoming a more popular university and college sport, and the professional teams are doing more recruiting from colleges than they did. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that UAF is very much in line with this. It seems that our hockey team has been getting constantly better. Just looking at your statistics, that your team records and your win-loss ratios are improving as the years go on. So there must be more popularity here and more emphasis on it. Is that...
Well, let me address the first part of your question there. Hockey has grown in popularity. It is a tremendous sport. In fact, it's unfortunate that it just doesn't lend itself to television coverage. It's a longer game. It doesn't fit nicely into the two-hour time block that television networks would like to see. It's a little bit difficult to follow the little black puck across the ice on a television screen. And then the sport is foreign to so many people, and only they would take the time, or if somebody would explain to them a few of the basic rules, they'd have a better understanding of the game. But the game, as you read earlier, it does include all those things, the excitement of a 4th of July pageant, and it is a fast game, it is a collision game, it's a finesse game. So it's grown in popularity because it is a tremendous sport. I'm very fortunate to be a part of it. I love the game dearly. If you were to come and visit any of our practices and compare it with some of the other practices, for example, a football practice, I don't know of any football players that look forward to going to a football practice.
Running
except
up against
maybe the
sandbags.
Yeah, except maybe the quarterback. You know, he probably, for him, it's okay. But it's a game where practice, and I don't know if our guys did, not to say that they're always smiling when they come out onto the ice for practice, but when the time comes for us to have a little scrimmage, a pickup scrimmage, it's a real physical activity that's enjoyable. So the players enjoy it. It's an exciting game for people to watch. The 1980 Olympics, the USA, certainly this brought it to the national attention. It helped increase it in popularity. This is where it started to grow in areas where it hadn't grown before, and ice rinks would spring up in places you would the least expect to find an ice rink.
That Olympic game had that much impact.
It certainly did. It did. Well, it was just everybody was aware of it. It brought a tear to nearly everyone's eye across the country, I think.
And it was a really a national patriotic event, that's for sure. I think people who had no experience with hockey whatsoever before really got into that.
It was the miracle, as the announcer referred to it. So it's grown in popularity. The big consideration, though, at the collegiate level, as I mentioned, is if there is an expense involved. There is more players involved, expensive equipment, and, of course, travel. And I think that this is one of the reasons why hockey wasn't started here a longer time ago. You should know that there was a hockey team here back in the 30s, though. In fact, in the archives here in the library, there's a scrapbook from a team. The UAF Nanox, or maybe I think they called them the Polar Bears at that time, had gone on a trip from here to Whitehorse to Juneau to Seattle, made their way through Canada by train, played in the University of Minnesota, went up to the School of Mines in Houghton, Michigan, and they had represented the state and the school. They'd taken off for 2 or 3 months. They were funded by, there was a dentist in town that happened to be a real fan of hockey, and it helped them raise the necessary funds to do so, and had a real experience. I think they'd taken the whole semester off. And,
does that sound good to you?
Yeah.
They're smiling here.
Yeah, they like to go. I don't know if they want to take the train all the way, but
no.
So there was a team at that time, and I'm told that there used to be an ice rink where the Eielson building is here and a few other places around campus where people would just get together and put the boards and the necessary time to put together an ice rink. The Beluga, of course, used to have an ice rink, and I'm told back in the early 70s, I know for sure that they had a team at that time. They didn't play very many games, maybe 10 or so, and a few teams from the outside would make it up here with help from the university. But then it went into a dormant period for a while, and then finally the construction of our beautiful ice arena and the push by people, the hockey fans in town here, and now we're at the point where we're quite pleased with what we've done so far, and look forward to doing even more in the future.
If there's anyone in our listening audience, well, certainly if you just have a question for my guest, I encourage you to call in 474-5044. But if anyone has any reminiscences of earlier hockey in Fairbanks, I would really appreciate if you'd call in and share those with us. Again, our number is 474-5044 with questions or comments on hockey. And we are not limiting this discussion simply to UAF hockey. I know there's a real active youth hockey program in town.
There is. There are some 600 youth hockey players here in Fairbanks alone. There's men's hockey leagues, a B league, an A league, a women's hockey, as I say, and of course the Fairbanks Gold Kings that have done very well in men's senior hockey. It's recognized by the American Amateur Hockey Association, and then last year they were runners up, and the year before the national champions. And last night they beat a team from Alberta, I believe.
Grand Center,
and
Grizzlies.
The Grizzlies. And
this is senior hockey.
Yes, and they play at the Big Dipper.
How old do you have to be in senior hockey?
Actually, there's no age limitations at all.
I mean, you can be young and be in senior hockey.
You better be good if you're young, but you could.
18
years old.
What I'm saying is senior sort of. usually connotes a geriatric league. This is not true. This is amateur hockey for adult men.
Correct.
Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. I was interested in your comments about the hockey history at the UAF. And from my recollections, in the early 60s, the administration then was really gung-ho on basketball, and that's where all the funds went.
Uh-huh.
The ice rink at that time was an outdoor rink. It was behind Wickersham on the spot where Wood Center is now located. And regardless of the weather, that's where the students turned out.
Uh-huh.
That's where all the participation was for the sports. Hockey was a real favorite at that time. And I don't know if my recollections are correct, but I have the feeling that the Beluga was essentially a student project through ASUA, raising funds to get some sort of enclosed hockey rink up. So, yes, hockey's been very popular and at this university, and it has had a lot of student support in the past.
Thank you very much for that information. So apparently there was a lot of unorganized interest in hockey, students doing intramural hockey playing, and then it was a sort of student effort that caused the administration to support it in a more organized way.
I think that's correct. I've heard the stories of,
thank you,
of students. They would attend the games at the Beluga or even the outdoor games, and they would stand right by the boards. They're right near the action, and they loved every minute of it. So it took their support to gain the attention of the administration to make it happen.
Well, that's often a very good way for things to happen, sure. to demonstrate the interest first, and then it's easier to put administrative support behind it. Again, our number is 474-5044. Any of our listeners who have comments about youth hockey, the senior program, Gold Kings, please feel free to call in and join us. 474-5044. 600 youth hockey players.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing number for the a town the size of this. What age does youth hockey start in an organized way? 5 years old?
I think they go as low as 5 years old, five or 6 years old, the mites.
They're so...
And they are.
Tiny kids, and they fly around.
They sure do. This is a swing and a miss and a fall and a get up and a stand and wave to mom and dad, and it's the start for them, and it's a lot of fun to watch. Parents enjoy it unless they play too many games outdoors, and then they don't enjoy it so much.
Do the parents get as violent and vicious as parents are known to do in Little League?
No,
they're much more civilized, right?
Well, there's really, they don't, there's not much they can do. They can cheer and support their kids, and I suppose there are a few instances where parents might get overly critical of the coach or the referee or something like this, but I guess that's human nature, and it's a part of everything. But
highly competitive sport.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about this reputation for scrappiness of hockey players. I was quite astounded by the reading that it's gotten much less violent in recent years, but it's still a real confrontational sport. Complete with penalty box and so on, and lots of terminology that has to do with high sticking and all sorts of things I don't understand. Do you suppose that I'll ask you, Don or Buddy, that it's sort of intrinsic, just in the nature of the sport, because of the high speed, because of the contact?
I think I wouldn't really call it violence. It's a physical game. And I think the game really got a bad name in the late 70s when it became really part of the show of the NHL. We were just talking the other day about the Philadelphia Flyers and people on their team named, Battleship and Moose. And, it was just it got to a point where it's just part of the show, where they dim
sort of
lights
like
and put the spotlight on the fights. And but they've really, it's really cleaned up the last couple of years.
So that was like sort of professional wrestling. A lot of it was...
Exactly. A lot of it's showmanship. And
not really serious.
Yeah. I think it's cleaned up quite a bit in the last few years, and the administration, the NHL, is really, really doing their part now. They're trying to cut out the stick swinging or, really heavy fines and heavy suspensions for any unnecessary violence.
So that's certainly not why you're into it. You're very peaceful. No. You're not, not anymore. You went through that stage in high school.
No.
Scrappiness. You have any thing to add on that?
Yeah, I don't think that you can consider like the checking and all that violence in the game. It's part of the game. It's like you don't go look at a football game or something and the tackling and consider that violence. It's part of the game. It's been accepted. You know, with hockey, a guy comes down the puck. There's one, you know, you got to knock him off the puck or do something to get the puck away from him. It's part of the game. You know, you got to take it as that. You know, occasionally the tempers flare. Like when you hit somebody, they might give you a stick back or something, you know, but it's part of the game.
It's a hard part of the, that part that Buddy was just talking about, that is, unfortunately, it is a part of the game, and it's hard to condone, it really is, and I'm talking about the extra violence, and I think that you were getting at, it is a contact sport, and all that, all the body contact is within the rules. It's the extra stuff that you see in the sports page, the photograph that you see in the highlights and television in the
stick
evenings.
Stick coming down on the head.
The incidents of the fighting. And this is where, this unfortunately, a lot of people that don't know that much about the sport, this is the image that they have because they've seen this from time to time. And there are those instances where it happens and where a team might go after somebody in the stand that threw a beer at them. And it's unfortunate. I don't know if they'll ever come a time when it'll be completely void of those occurrences. Except, as Don mentioned, the NHL officials and all officials at all levels of hockey are certainly not condoning it. They're taking some more strict rules to prevent this from happening. I can say this at the collegiate level that it is beyond condoning. We don't condone it at all. Any sort of fighting, it's an automatic disqualification. That person is out that game, and he's out the next game. If it happens again, he's out that game, and a second time.
So it's not simply going into the penalty box for 2 minutes.
No, right? Not at all. In fact, a fighting penalty is out. We want nothing to do with that person for the rest of the game. And as I say, he's out the next game. If it happens again, he's out that game and two games. So really, the hockey season at the college level is not that long, 33 games or so. If a person gets involved in two fights, he's going to miss five games. It happens another time, he's going to be out eight games. So if he really wants to play hockey, he's going to do what he can to avoid those.
You really can't afford to carry that kind of person on your roster.
No.
Okay, tell me then, what is a penalty and what puts you in the box? And
well, there are a number of different infractions of the rules, such things as tripping, obvious taking your stick and pulling the skates out from somebody else, one of your opponents, causing him to fall. Well, that would give your team an unfair advantage. And the
sort of like clipping in football.
Yeah,
or
something like that. And that's why there are different, you know, different yard penalties in football. And this is considered to be a minor penalty. And that person sits in the penalty box for 2 minutes. Other examples of minor penalties would be high sticking and elbowing, holding, hooking, the use of the stick to impede the progress of an opponent.
That penalty box then is like losing yards in football, is sort of equivalent.
Well, actually, it's losing, but not necessarily losing yards. It's losing a player.
Right.
So you're at a real disadvantage. You're in a man short, a penalty killing situation, and your opponents are in what's called a power play. They have one extra person on the ice, which is a real advantage.
That's what I was going to get to. That becomes a whole strategy part of the game. That it's sort of like the last 2 minutes in football when you are either short a player or when the other team is short a player. That changes your whole strategy. Is that correct?
You're playing. You're playing on a big surface, 80 feet wide, 200 feet long. You know, one less person, they can just move it around the outside, and they're getting a lot of shots on goal, unnecessary shots. So it's a risky time if you're short a player.
It's a very exciting part of the game. This is the one.
It speeds up at that point.
Well, it can slow down. It's one part of the game that'll bring the spectators to the edge of their seat if it's a close game, because it's usually the team with the man advantage has control of the puck, and it's their ability to handle that puck and maneuver to a good shooting position. And it's interesting how they can control the puck and create those opportunities. And, of course, the defensive team, their objective is just to get the puck and send it down to the other end. And they're trying to delay the game, essentially, for the 2 minutes until they can get their player back on the ice. So it's a real exciting part of the game.
Would you compare hockey more to basketball in terms of all the players having to be more well-rounded, versatile, doing a lot of different skills, having a lot of different skills, than rather than being really specialized?
I don't know what to say about that.
Is there a big difference between a defensive player and an offensive player?
Yeah.
But it seems to me that it's... But it seems to me that from some of these stories that I've read, that there have been some real changes in that, that through time, defensive players were limited clearly to defense. And then I was reading something about Bobby Orr really changing that, because he developed a totally different style where he sort of... He was a defensive player, but he did a lot of offensive moves in terms of carrying the puck.
Yeah, some real offensive skills. Actually, there are similarities. In basketball, there are the guards who are like our defensemen, and they, too, have to be able to score when the situation calls for it, but their primary responsibility is defensive responsibilities.
Which is to keep the opponents from...
keep them at bay, keep them from creating a score.
Putting that puck in that...
In the net. And the same is true with the forwards. That's their primary responsibility to score goals. Although, well, that's not to say that's exclusively their responsibility. They have other responsibilities as well. A good team, the successful team, is that team that has not only people capable of scoring goals, but those that are capable and willing to work hard to prevent goals scored against their team. So, yes, there are some similarities between basketball and... But they don't have any body contact, and they have too many timeouts, and they have a loud horn that drives everyone crazy. But aside from that,
wait a minute.
I read
for a while. First, you had a whistle in hockey, and then because they were playing at outdoor rinks, this one referee was tired of putting a whistle in his mouth that was totally frozen and losing the skin off of his lip, and so he switched to dinner bell. Did you know this?
No,
this,
I didn't know
this. This is strange but true. he switched to a dinner bell, and then they started covering the rinks over, and then they went back to the whistle. And I can understand from a referee's point of view why at 20 below you wouldn't want to be putting that little metal thing in your mouth and trying to blow it. Put the whistle in your mouth and lose it.
Well, then they shouldn't blow the whistle so much. I wish our referees' lips would freeze more often.
And another funny story about the guy who was the timekeeper, and he was in the audience, and this one team kept scoring goals, and he couldn't get out to tell them that the time was up, and that's when they decided they would put the clock over the rink and not have somebody just in the audience doing it. It's been a real popular sport for a long time. I was amazed to discover that they had audiences of 5,000 people in the early 1900s attending hockey games in Ottawa and Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
That's
And as the stadiums grew in size, they filled those up. Chicago Stadium, for a number of years, they filled the capacity just about every game. Same in Detroit, the old Olympia Arena, the old classic hockey arena, and they used to fill up all the time too. This is of course when the NHL, National Hockey League, was just a 6 or 8 team league, and some of the old rivalries with Montreal and Toronto, New York, and, Chicago, Detroit, it was very popular in those areas, but it just wasn't it hadn't been introduced and marketed to other areas. In fact, that brings me to a point you had asked. We talked about the 70s when hockey was a violent sport. Hockey had expanded. They finally realized that they had a saleable
money maker.
Okay, and they decided that they would go into new markets. But to do so, they had to promote it as well as they could, and to gain the interest of some people that didn't know much about the sport and didn't have a chance to really appreciate the finer points of the game. They had to sell the rough stuff, and that's where the names like Battleship evolved and some of the crazy occurrences. This is really, it was a black eye that lingers on, as a matter of fact, on the sport of ice hockey, the 70s. It was a real turbulent time where fighting was a recognized part of the game. In fact, it had gotten so bad that it had gotten to the collegiate level and down in the youth hockey level, where it wasn't uncommon at all to see a fisticuff at a youth game, which was really disappointing. And as a parent, I'm sure there are lots of parents at that time decided that they just would not have their child involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, that's not the case at all.
So you think that was partly a byproduct of the expansion to the World Hockey League?
Oh, I feel very strongly about that. Also, the expansion of the NHL. They had expanded and gone into new cities, Atlanta, for example, Los Angeles, cities that hockey wasn't... familiar to sports fans there.
and that wasn't ultimately successful. Did the World Hockey League fail?
Yes, the World Hockey Association failed.
I'm sorry, WHA, yep. World Hockey Association. Okay. Then what happened? Some of those expansion teams became part of the NHL?
A few did, but not very
Denver
many.
Denver got a team?
Three.
Hartford, Edmonton.
Right. Hartford, has that team succeeded, the Hartford Whalers?
They're doing better this year, yes.
People were surprised that such a little town could do well. So now now there are how many teams in the National Hockey League? 22?
21.
22. And American teams are winning. When did the Long Island team win the Stanley Cup?
Oh, they've won it for 3 years in a row, but now the new dynasty is in Edmonton, your birthplace.
Yes.
The Oilers and Wayne Gretzky, they seem to have a real stranglehold on the rest of the league. They're a very good hockey team.
And they're absolutely avid fans in Edmonton, of course.
They love their Oilers.
They love their Oilers. Tell us about some of the really famous hockey players. Wayne Gretzky is the preeminent hockey player now. Where's Wayne from?
He's from Ontario.
Uh-huh.
Bellevue, I think. Belleville, something.
Uh-huh.
Southern Ontario.
Did he go to school to... Did he come out of a university system, or did he
go
straight from?
No, he played junior hockey. He played Tier 1 junior hockey in Sault Ste. Marie. And from there, he started playing professional hockey when he was 17 in the WHA.
Uh-huh.
And
Indianapolis.
Yeah. And the owner there, Nelson Scalabrini, just kept him when he moved to Edmonton, and he's been there ever since.
What's so special about his skills? What makes him such a special...
It's magic. He's just got the touch. He's born with it, I guess.
He's an exceptional hockey player, has been all his life. The scoring records, as a youngster, he probably set the mini-mite record that still holds. He is magical, as Don says. He has a sense about him that he knows where his teammates are always going to be. He is an extremely accurate passer. He's unselfish with the puck, and not exceptionally fast or physically awesome, but he just does so many things so well, and especially when it comes to scoring goals. He has a very accurate shot, and as I say, just that sense that knows what's going to happen before it actually happens, and that's what sets him apart from the other hockey players.
Before him, the one person that everybody was following was Bobby Orr. Is that
Bobby Orr was a phenomenon of the 70s. He was, as you mentioned, was the start of the new defenseman. The offensive defenseman. He was a leading scorer in the league. He was a tremendous stick handler, and he too could rush a puck up the ice and make things happen, create the scoring opportunities. Very exceptional skater and bold, courageous, everything combined in one. And he certainly was Boston's favorite boy. And
he played for the Boston Bruins.
The Boston Bruins, and then he had knee problems, and it ended his career. It should have ended.
How long does... I mean, I know you can't generalize because it depends on injuries, but how long can one really expect to play competitive hockey?
I think the average professional career now is about 5 years.
Oh, shorter than... Or same as football, around the same as football.
I think shorter.
Probably shorter.
Because of injuries or just because of the strength and endurance that you need to play competitively?
It's really just a move towards youth. Everybody coming in the league now is 18, 19 years old. They're just bringing in younger and younger people every year.
And they seem like they're bigger and stronger and faster and quicker every year, too.
So at 22, you can be over the hill.
You could be.
Or over the ice. What are your aspirations, Don?
Really, right now, I have none. This is my final year of college hockey. I got another year of school left, so my plans are really still up in the air. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Is it likely at your advanced age that you could be picked up by...
Oh, no, no aspirations of that, really.
You're not... you don't feel you're professional?
Not in hockey, anyway.
Not in hockey.
Maybe basketball.
How about you, buddy? This is...
No, I got one more year of college eligibility left, and I'm just going to finish up with hockey there and probably go into coaching youth hockey or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But you do have a player that there is some talk about him going on, and that's Steve Maria.
Steve Moore.
Captains no. here told me before we went on the air they didn't want to talk about this guy. You use a lot of ink in your Nano Cocky records. When you look through them, I'm Steve is just everywhere here. How long has Steve been here with the UAF team?
Okay, Steve has been with us now for 2 years, 2.5 years. This is his third season here. And yes, he has made a number of records. He happens to be our answer to the Wayne Gretzky. He's an exceptional playmaker, stick handler, scorer. He's done extremely well.
Look at these hat tricks here. He's got all the hat tricks.
Scored in 64 consecutive games. He's actually on the verge of an NCAA record. We're downplaying it until that actually happened, but there may come a day when...
Why, are we superstitious, or...?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we can't talk about this.
No, we're just...
He made USA Today the other...
One
day this week, actually.
He's pretty well known now around the college hockey fraternity. Unfortunately, he was overlooked for the All-American team last year, an honor that I think he deserved, but it was a...
Someone said that was an oversight.
Oversight, yes. But nonetheless, he's a very prolific goal scorer and a welcome addition to our team. Whether or not he has a professional career ahead of him, that remains to be seen. There, unfortunately, we're quite a ways away from the normal stops on any professional scouting itinerary. We just don't see many scouts stop by Fairbanks to take a look at our team. It's not on the way. Well, maybe to Siberia.
They do a lot of recruiting there.
We haven't seen any guys with the old fedora hat sitting in the crowd taking notes, so we know they aren't here.
But you go on the road.
But we go on the road, and he will be seen there and again and again and again. And the only drawback that he has, he's older. He's 23 years old, and they're looking for the 18, 19-year-old old players. But that's not to say that he couldn't make a contribution to some teams. And right now, he won't. He won't get picked up by any team and offered a big contract to come and join them. At best, he'd probably get a tryout opportunity, and he just may do very well doing that. And if he chooses to do so, another opportunity for him would be, and with all of our players for that matter, the possibility of going overseas and playing hockey,
In
Switzerland, in Sweden, Germany, Norway. There are a number of opportunities in Austria and other places where they could go. And each team over there is allowed to have one, maybe two foreign players on their team to help their team. And a little added attraction for them. And it's a great opportunity for young players to do something like this their first year out of school.
See something of the world. Did you enjoy your time in Switzerland?
Yeah, I had a great time. I was only over there for 8 days, but we really had a good time. It was fun, really pretty.
Did you enjoy your time last year in Bemidji?
Oh, it wasn't as pretty.
No.
It wasn't
Paul Bunyan Land was fun, though.
I think we should talk a little bit about the changes in the divisions that have been made. We were a Division II team, is that correct?
That's correct.
And they... what did they do?
They eliminated
Division II, which now puts us in a different competitive division.
Before there were three divisions of college hockey: Division I, II, and III. And Division I is the big time of college hockey, where schools are allowed to offer up to 20 scholarships. Division II, we could offer up to 15, but not many schools had the wherewithal to do that. Division III offered no scholarship based on athletic ability, strictly on your need. So three different levels. So there were only 16 teams at the Division II level, and as I've already mentioned, it is expensive for a team of 20 players and two coaches and trainer and so on to travel anywhere. So it was an expense to the NCAA to sponsor a Division II tournament each year, and so there just weren't enough Division II teams. Last year there were some 16 Division II teams, and it was extremely expensive for them to sponsor it. Although the final games drew good attendance, it wasn't enough to offset the expense of the travel. So
and UAF was, let's blow your horn a little bit, UAF was in the playoffs.
We were in the semifinals against Bemidji State University. Had traveled down to Bemidji to play them and lost in a two-game total goal series, 13-8. I think the final score was over two games.
And I know you had some fans that were such dedicated fans that they, at their own expense, went down to Bemidji to cheer you on.
There were a few good supporters. Marty Agner.
Hi, Marty. I hope you're out there. Marty is head of the Booster Club this year.
Yes, she is. She's out an awful lot. So the NCAA, anyhow, decided that those 16 teams had to make a decision to go to join the Division III level or to move up to Division I. And both the University of Alaska and Anchorage and ourselves, we are two of the schools, along with, I think, a couple other ones on the East Coast, that decided to move up to the Division I level and play with the big boys, literally. And now the problem is that we just are not a part of any league where we are, and we're in the process of making formal application. We've conferred with the athletic directors from the three other schools that are in similar situations to us, and they are United States International University in San Diego, Northern Arizona and Flagstaff, Arizona, and, of course, UAA. And together we all feel that our future needs to include affiliation with some league. And we are applying to what's called the Central Collegiate Hockey Association, teams that are primarily in the Michigan, Ohio, Illinois area.
Mm-hmm.
And so far they've been receptive to our overtures, and this is a league that we would like to get into. It would certainly help us with our scheduling, to develop some rivalries, to gain notoriety, and also to help us come closer to achieving our ultimate goal, and that is to become recognized nationally and have a chance to play for the national championship. And in order to do this, we have to be a part of a league.
Uh-huh.
And so this is the direction we're moving now.
Being a member of a league makes you more attractive to really top-flight hockey players in terms of coming to UAF.
Yes, that would help
us. And also allows you to compete on a more regular basis. You're playing tonight and tomorrow night.
That's correct.
You're playing St. Cloud?
St. Cloud State University from St. Cloud, Minnesota. They were last year a Division II team, and they're one of the schools that decided to move to a Division III level. Although they have aspirations of moving into a Division I level eventually.
Mm-hmm.
They're a good college hockey team. They have a lot of good hockey players on their team from Minnesota. They're well coached, and we expect a good game with them. We had a very good game with them last year. In fact, a tie game until late in the game, and fortunately for us, we scored the final goal late in the game and won that one. So we know that we're going to have a very formidable opponent tonight.
How has it felt to the two of you this year being playing against Division I teams? Has it been a harder schedule this year?
Yeah, so far this year, yeah.
You've noticed the difference?
Better teams, yeah.
It's a lot funner, too. You know, you're out there competing against someone who's better than you or at equal talent, and, you know, you're putting yourself to a test, which is...
You have to reach.
Yeah, exactly.
How are you doing? How's the season?
We're 5-6-3-1 right now, and we're hoping to go home at Christmas 10-3-1. We got four big games in the next week, and I think we're doing fairly well. We've played pretty good hockey to this point, and hopefully it'll continue on.
Fairly injury free this year.
Actually, no, we've had a few bad breaks really so far this year, but hopefully by the time Christmas comes around, we'll be healthy again and ready for our road trip.
I noticed that you don't have a lot of seniors on your team. Is that a hopeful? You're it.
Don, yeah, it's me.
Don is it. Does that make the prospects for next year?
I would say next year. Yeah.
That next year we'll lose 10 guys. It's about 10 people next year.
Yes. yes, it does make us optimistic for this year and for the coming year. Certainly we'll miss Don's presence next year, although, as he says, he has another year of school. He'll be here in body, but not on the ice with us. And then we will have my assistant coach, Don Lucia, and I have a real task ahead of us this year and next year to find some replacements capable of filling the skates of these players that we have on our squad right now.
I noticed looking through your roster you have some players on the team from Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. So we are succeeding from our youth hockey program of getting some good players, and they're happily staying with us.
Mm-hmm. There are a few, and there are a few good ones coming up. One thing that in the state, hockey has really grown in popularity here in Alaska as well. There are a number of ice rinks, indoor ice rinks in our state, too, in our community of 30,000 people, which is quite amazing. But the numbers just aren't there right now.
They're in terms of population.
In terms of population and number of students play the game of hockey, to expect us to come close to, certainly not to complete it, filling a whole team of exclusively Alaskans, but but even to complementing our team, it just it takes an exceptional student athlete, the ones that we find recruit from elsewhere, and it'll take an exceptional student athlete from Fairbanks or anywhere else in Alaska to join our team as well. The competition, as we get better, it's going to be even more difficult for our athletes to stay at home and join us. Although we would like that very much, but it still have to get better just as we're getting better.
How are our high school teams in Fairbanks doing in terms of state competition?
Well, I don't know.
They just started.
As a matter of fact, there are a couple of games this afternoon at the UAF Arena that I'll be going to right after this. Palmer High School is up there playing Monroe High School, and Wasilla High School is playing Lathrop, I believe, this afternoon at our place, if not Westphalia. I'm not certain which one. But
so all our high schools have teams?
North Pole they play this afternoon. Yes, they do. And then there's also a Midget A team, which is really, quite frankly, it's robbed a few of the high school teams of their best players. This is a chance. These are the players that want to play hockey at an accelerated level, more games than what the high school league offers. And, in fact, they just recently returned from a trip to Los Angeles where they competed in the Los Angeles Kings Midget Tournament. And I think they did quite well. I'm not certain if they won it all, but I know they won their fair share of games. And these are the first real group of outstanding hockey players that are coming up that are prime candidates to join our program.
Are those amateur players still at Midget A?
Oh, yes.
And they support themselves by fundraising efforts in the community?
It's at expense of the parents, of course, too. And I think that they're being partially funded by the Gold Kings, who they do quite well at the box office and other sales. And they are supporting the youth hockey quite well.
And the Gold Kings are they're a professional team.
Well, it's a non-profit.
Non-profit.
Players aren't paid for their
professional.
Semi-professional.
Oh, I don't even know if you could call it that. They
all have to have other jobs.
They do. They do. They have a few little bonuses. Matter of fact, they're going on a nice trip over the holidays or right after the holidays. They're going to Holland, I think, for 11 days or so with the playing some teams. So they get around, and I think actually they're quite well known in the men's senior hockey circle.
Uh-huh, and they're very competitive, and I know their games are extremely well attended.
Yes, they are.
In the Big Dipper.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously have a good climate, very responsive climate for hockey in terms of our spectator support. You have good attendance at your games?
We've been having good attendance, but far this year. We've been hurt also because they have all our games been Monday and Tuesday nights. You know, and that's a lot for us.
Tonight's our first weekend.
Yeah.
So.
How have you been doing against Anchorage this year?
We play them next week for the first time
at
Anchorage.
So you're psyched for that?
Yeah.
What do you expect to do? You have a better team this year than they do?
Oh, we hope so. Find out next week.
We know we do. It's just a matter of whether we go there ready to play.
Is this the arch rivalry, Fairbanks and Anchorage?
In
all things.
As in all things. We don't let the rivalry die at hockey. In fact, it's brought to life again. Now, as Don mentioned, we play most of our games on Monday, Tuesday nights. The teams that come up and play us will play two games in Anchorage and two in Fairbanks. And just the way it worked out, the first number of games they played Friday and Saturday in Anchorage and Monday and Tuesday at our place. Now, this is a weekend series for us, and we hope that we get a full house tonight. We've come close a number of times this year. We probably average 800 people at our game.
How many people does the arena
hold? We have seating for 1,200, and we have standing room for next to 200 or 300 above that. And we think that we have a very exciting product. And tonight I know we have a whole crew from the library staff here coming over, some 40, 50. We've reserved a section for them and give them a chance to hoot and holler and have a good time. And we hope that we have quite a few more people to join them and enjoy themselves watching a good college hockey game. I think they'll see that. Well, that's really, quite frankly, as I see it, this is as important as it is to us and the players. It's a real necessary diversion for the student body. There's a chance for them to get out of the dorms to do something other than go to the pub or elsewhere. And it's a healthy outlet, as I see it, a sporting event where they have a chance to really let themselves go in a healthy manner. And we've made some great strides in cultivating more student interest. We feel that we have a good following right now, but we think there's even room for more. And we encourage anyone, especially those that have never seen a hockey game, to come and sit next to somebody that may have seen a game before, explain what an offside is, an icing is. And if they
can't
do it, a hat trick.
A power play.
A power play or any of those things. And if they don't understand that, we hand out a three-page handout to people explaining the rules of hockey. So
well, it's a fast game. It's a lively game. It's action-packed, the opposite of cricket. Well, thank you very much for being in the studio with me, the co-captains of the UAF team, Buddy Bender, Don Jameson, and the UAF hockey coach, Rick Schaefer. Thank you very much. I look forward to having my audience join me next week. We're going to discuss oral history, a favorite topic of mine, and I look forward to talking with you at that time. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. Have a very good weekend.
You're listening to KUAC FM in Fairbanks. This afternoon at 1, a special presentation of The Marriage of Figaro, hosted by Russell Stratton, Associate Professor of English at the University of Alaska. And next week at 1, we begin the season for the Texaco Metropolitan Opera. This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. It's now 1 minute past 12, and time for the National Press Club.
Support for this program is provided by NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Bank America Foundation for Business and Economic Reporting, Mead Data Central for Nexus Research Services, and for the coverage of science, Hewlett-Packard, worldwide supplier of computers and instrumentation for business and science. This program is a production of NPR, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., National Public Radio presents another in the continuing series of broadcasts from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stacio, and today's guest speaker is Democratic Representative Morris Udall.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is John Fogarty. I'm president of the Press Club and Washington correspondent of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members, their guests seated in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over the 303 national public radio stations or watching over the 1,800 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some coming events. On Monday, October 29th, next Monday, our guest will be Democratic National Committee Chairman Chuck Manatt, and on this is jumping way ahead, but on November 20th, we will have H. Ross Perot, president of the EDS Corporation, who is the new owner of a privately held copy of the Magna Carta, which he intends to lend to the National Archives, but more to the point is the chairman of a commission that initiated sweeping reforms in Texas schools, and he will be speaking about what's happening and what's needed to improve schools, not only in Texas, but nationwide. Now, what do I do? Yes. I'd like to remind our audience at this point that if you have any questions for our speaker today, and I trust that you will, please write them on cards at your tables and pass them up to me. I'll ask as many as time allows, and please, if you will, print clearly or write clearly. Some questions don't get asked simply because I can't read them. I'd now like to introduce the guests at our head table, ask our guests to please stand briefly when their names are read, also ask you and the audience to withhold your applause until all of the names have been read. Starting at my left, Steve Misner, Arizona Daily Star, Lori McGinley, Wall Street Journal, Paul Magnuson, Knight Ridder Newspapers, Kay Kaler, Newhouse News Service, Ann Hoy, Arizona Republic, Lim Kimchi McGrath, president of Lim Kimchi & Associates, and a member of our speakers committee who organized today's luncheon, Vince Fabrizio, the son of our speaker, Judy Grandy, Cleveland Plain Dealer, and the chairman of the chairperson of the NPC Speakers Committee. Judy has put me through consciousness-raising school. Jim Gehan, Gannett News Service. Bill Plant, CBS News. Carol Russo, a guest of the speaker. Phil Shabakoff, New York Times. Maria Rethio, McGraw-Hill. Sean Griffin, Phoenix Gazette. thank all of our head table guests for being with us, and also thank you in the audience. It's getting easier. I used to apologize if you happened to find your way to the ballroom. It's getting easier. In 1976, Representative Morris Udall ran for president. While he did not win the Democratic presidential nomination, he will always have the distinction of having been the first former professional basketball player to seek the White House. Now, there's a senator from New Jersey who I think is going to add to that list, but he was the first. Now, you'll have to search pretty hard to find Mr. Udall's pro basketball statistics for the Denver Nuggets, but you don't have to look very far to see what he's accomplished in his 23 years in Congress. As chairman of the House Interior Committee, he's had a major hand in the passage of the Alaska Lands Bill, the 1977 National Strip Mine Reclamation Law, and the Nuclear Waste Management Policy Act. He's also gained passage of civil service reform measures and campaign finance reform laws. He's helped rewrite the rules for the Democratic Party's 1984 primaries and the National Convention as a member of the Hunt Commission. He has long favored breaking up major oil companies. He's also not too fond of major newspaper chains. Established the establishment of national health insurance and a variety of other controversial issues. He's a reformer in the House who once challenged John McCormick for Speaker. He later lost a race for Majority Leader, largely because he ran against McCormick. But despite his advocacy of controversial legislation, his push for reforms, Mo Udall remains a popular and even beloved figure on Capitol Hill. As Congressional Quarterly put it in its book, Politics in America, quote, unfailing grace and a few good jokes have allowed Udall to evolve from brash reformer to elder statesman in a relatively short time without making a real enemy in the House. Now, the last time he was at the National Press Club, Representative Udall announced that he would not seek the presidency in 1984. Now, I don't know if he sees the polls and is now thinking about challenging George Bush in 1988, but it's a pleasure to welcome Representative Udall back to this podium again, and I do so now. Thank you for being here.
Reverend clergy, distinguished journalists, if any, and fellow taxpayers. I came here today to play America's newest indoor and outdoor game called Kicking Posterior at Yale University, where it originated. But with this nationwide broadcast audience, I'm not sure that I can refer to it in proper time. It's used best to this game in debate, and this is not a debate. I don't want to say that the last debate was dull, but I can report that C-SPAN tuned it out after 30 minutes in favor of some old reruns of the Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee.